Let's start our final segment. What I was talking about before the present break was how we laid out static data in memory. But actually, we're going to have more power than that. We're actually going to be able to put a variety of data structures in memory and have our generated code use them. So if, for example, we imagine this rectangular box is the memory we have available. And remember, that's virtual memory mapped by the operating system onto real memory. I can imagine this starts at location zero for convenience up to some very large number, including possibly the maximum addressability of a particular processor. In the old days, that used to be limited. Old 32-bit processors could address maximum, I believe, of 4 gigabytes. But now that we have 32-bit processors, it's way, way, way more. So for our convenience, let's just assume that's 4 gigabytes. But the actual amount would be, what, 4 gigabytes squared? So it'd be 16. What's a gigabyte squared? There's giga, tera, peta. What comes after peta? Femto? Something like that. Just, even so, these days, you can think of memory. I guess these days, we're used to thinking about terabytes. But does anybody talk about petabytes? I think what they say, the entire content of the World Wide Web is a couple of petabytes. Is that the claim? That much? Does it really? Is that true? My God, see? Good, yeah. I mean, this is just not an idle thing. One of the goals that many people have is a way of capturing images of the worldwide net from time to time, if only for historical purposes. It's one of those difficulties that I'm of the old generation where I still order and read a newspaper every day. Now, I'm sure all of you read, but I bet you there aren't very many of you that still bother to buy a paper newspaper anymore. I mean, it's out of date, right? But here's the hard part. Think about 50 or 100 years from now when people want to know how we lived 50 years ago, right now. One of the ways people have done it in the past is they looked at newspapers, and not major things like who killed who or anything like that, but what's the price of a pound of hamburger in situation, or who got arrested for having a dog that barked too much, or little things like that. But with no more newspapers, how are people in future going to decide how you lived? For example, you know, they might have some TV show where they want to know how would somebody coming into Epic Systems on this day be dressed? And they might think of you, you know, as a show dress that's totally different. They'd have to see pictures. But where would they find pictures? They might in a newspaper. They might have a picture of you with the groundbreaking for one of the new buildings. But there are no newspapers anymore. So how do they find that? And how do they know the date's correct? And on and on and on. So a lot of issues there. But anyway, getting back, we own 4 gigabytes of virtual address space. And what we're going to do is put our program in that. Now, we know we're not going to use 4 gigabytes, and we don't have to because of memory mapping. If we use way less, the part we use will be mapped into real memory. The part we don't use will be pretty much ignored. And that gives us some advantages. I was just talking previously about some data and programs are statically allocated. It means we put them in memory once at a fixed location, and they never change. So that might very well be a program. That means if we want to call method M, we know method M begins at such and such an address, and we do a transfer of control to that address to begin executing M. So we'd have the program. We might have globals. And also static. Those are data that are going to be used throughout the life of a program or have to have their values maintained across the execution of a program. But we're going to turn out there are a couple of other data structures we're going to be able to add in. One I'm just about to talk about here is that all programs assume they have a runtime stack. So we'll have a stack. And a stack can grow and shrink. I showed you an example of that of an operand stack. We'll show you in a bit. We use stacks to actually allocate the data for subprograms. That's one of the ways we're able to support recursion effectively. Turns out there's another memory allocation technique people use, which is called heap allocation, when you're using Java or C++ and you do a new this or a new that, that comes out as something called a heap. Depending on the language, heaps can be deallocated manually. That is, besides a new, you can have something called a free or a dispose. But many languages, including Java and C#, have garbage collection. Garbage collection is one of these wonderful things that if you have it, you're never going to not want to have it again. Situation, many of you are still young enough that you go home occasionally and visit mom and dad. And you may have noticed one of the cool things about visiting mom and dad, particularly mom, is magic things happen. You get up out of bed and throw your jammies on the floor and go and clean up. And when you get back, what happens? The jammies are all nicely folded and the bed is made and it's all happened magically. When you get back to your real home, that doesn't quite happen. And what happens instead is you don't make the bed and all of a sudden the cat or dog finds about it and they're squeezed in, you know, and found a nice sleeping spot. Or you see your jammies and you say, oh, wait a minute, those are starting to ferment. Maybe I better do something about them. So garbage collection is kind of like having mom around to clean up after you. And what that means is in heap allocation, that's garbage collected. And I'll talk about how that's done in languages like Java or C#. The system is smart enough to figure out when you don't need anything anymore. It's the equivalent of throwing the jammies on the floor. And that's kind of an indication that they could be collected, cleaned up, laundered perhaps, and recycled for future use. Like tomorrow night when you want to have fresh jammies to have. Heap allocation does that, and the cool thing about heap allocation is it has no limits, except the very broadest ones, I guess, of how much heap memory you need. In the old days, when you developed a program, you had to put artificial limits on it. I'm going to build something, but it can only handle data up to such and such a number. These days, programs are more flexible, and you can have programs that have huge amounts of data. We have in the computer science department some computer scientists who do Excel programs. Well, nothing magic about Excel programs, but they have literally millions of lines and columns, and what they do is they simulate major portions of the United States or the international economy. They have little things in here and says, you know, that, you know, here's the price of gasoline. Well, if the price of gasoline goes up, that means the price of produce, like fresh fruit, is going to have to go up. The price of fresh fruit is going to go up. You're going to sell that much less of it. If you sell that much less of it, that means the farmer is going to want to grow a little bit less of it, and on and on and on. So they're actually able to have programs that are way bigger than anyone who ever invented Excel would have imagined. And they use the Excel model of having cells interact with cells. And those things can actually be run on computers. So millions of lines, millions of cells, when you have gigabytes of space, doesn't really mean anything. And remember, now we have 64-bit processors, so the old 4-gigabyte limit is gone. Another game we can play. Yeah, question. Say a little louder. The diagram. This is the context of a memory image we're creating as part of our compilation process. We're going to build a program, and our program is going to have to be placed in memory because we're the ones as compiler writers deciding where things go. So in this context, these are addresses, and here's the spot where we're actually saying the various data items may be found in our memory image. So we're going to have a stack, which I'll talk about shortly, but I was getting a little ahead, that will also have a heap. And we'll be able to have heap allocation. And the heap allocation will allow us to have the notion that we can allocate as much data as we need in any order and still have it be properly handled. And with garbage collection, we have the ability to assume that a program may be able to run indefinitely, even if it's creating more and more data, some of which becomes garbage. So some of you, I don't know if any of your programs have this, but historically there have been problems with programs that have memory leaks. A memory leak is something where the program runs continuously and it gathers more and more memory and doesn't return it. So the image of the program gets bigger and bigger, and as a result it gets slower and slower. And sometimes, I mean, it used to be the case certain browsers. I think the Firefox browser, until a couple years ago, if you had too many tabs that ran too long, it would get bloated. Its image in memory would get bigger and bigger and bigger, and it would drive out other things. And eventually, you know, you just have situations like Old Yeller. And I'm an animal lover, so I don't want to say what happened to Old Yeller, but whatever happened to Old Yeller happened to this thing. You take him out to the back of the barn and put him out of his memory, misery, and restart the process. So that's part of our job. Notice if we write compilers that allow memory to grow and grow and grow and grow without limit, then one of our ideals, namely that programs that can run indefinitely, and it used to be the case that programs crashed often enough, it didn't matter. But I mean, certainly the situation, I don't know about System 7, but certainly Mac OS, it can run 30 days without having to be rebooted. And if System 7 is good, you may want to reboot it or turn it off, but it's not like the system's getting clumsier and clumsier and slower and slower, and let's reboot it and see if good things happen. So this context then is how we're going to try to lay out memory, virtual memory, in a way that's as flexible as possible for a user. And one of the questions that comes up is, why did I put the heap in one end growing toward the left and the other, the stack, growing at the left end growing towards the right? I put them fairly far apart, and why did I do that? Well, some of you might probably took chemistry, and I know this is a little simplified, but what happens when you mix nitro and glycerine? I don't think it's really that simple, but theoretically, nitroglycerine is what? A very volatile explosive, and bad things happen. Well, what happens here if our stack and heap run into each other? Bad things happen. Namely, our stack gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and a heap gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and they run into each other, and that's bad. That's one of the reasons why we're using the full range of virtual memory. I'm assuming just 4 gigabytes, it could be more. Because the further I put these guys apart, the harder it's going to be for these guys to run into each other. Particularly if I have garbage collection. What garbage collection does is not just return unused garbage, but it also compacts the heap so it uses less apparent space. That is, not only does mom fold your laundry, but she puts it in the drawer very neatly so the jammies are in one spot and the socks are in another and the shirts are in yet another. So it does a lot of housekeeping in a very positive way. So that's sort of the context of what we're getting into. And the earlier of the two, stack allocation predates heap allocation by a substantial amount. The problem that with stack allocation, or what motivated stack allocation, was twofold. One is we have lots of methods in typical programs, hundreds, perhaps thousands. They call them functions or subprograms or whatever, same idea. But not all these are running at the same time. So if you allocate memory for all the methods, all the functions you have, you're going to waste space. What's equally dangerous is, what if you happen to have a recursive function, a recursive method? In the old days, those were forbidden. And the reason they were forbidden is if I have something like function f, and I statically allocate it, and f has some data, and f calls itself, say f of 3 calls f of 2, and I'll give an example of that shortly. The spot where the parameter is saved for function f better not be a single location, because if it is, the 2 and the 3 are going to step on each other, and that's probably not a good thing. So what people decided was anything that's potentially recursive, we'll push it on a stack, and each incarnation of a recursive routine will get different memory location. Moreover, methods will only get data when they're called. That means I can have hundreds of methods which may take a lot of data. This was particularly relevant when memories were smaller. But even now, hundreds or thousands of methods can still take lots of data. We won't allocate the memory for a method until it starts running. If it isn't running, its data is not allocated because it can't be used. It only can be used when the method is activated. That's why local data is local. It means when the method is active, I'll allocate it. When it's inactive, I won't. So this is the notion of having a stack. So what will happen is, let me go to a little picture. Let's look at the bottom of the screen there. This is the notion of having a little method here. It takes a parameter, and it has an array and a local variable and a little bit of computation. What will happen for this particular method is I need data for it. I'm going to need space for all three of those things, the parameter A, a local variable B, and the array C. And what I'll do is I'll package this together into one unit, And this will be called a frame for reasons I'm not quite sure of. It was also something that's called an activation record, which made a little more sense. Activation means call or activate, make alive. And the record is a record of the data you had for it. But basically what will happen is, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, is that you'll lay out in advance not the exact location where the data will go, but relative location of where the data will go relative to the beginning of the frame. So in our little example here, we'll need some control information. For example, one of the things a subprogram stores when it's called is a return address. Why is that? Well, I might have one copy of a method, and I may have many calls to it. So suppose this method gets called, and he says, okay, I'm done. It's time to return. Return where? There's many possible call sites. Which one do I go to? So what subprograms typically do is, when you call a subprogram, it's given an extra parameter beyond the explicit parameters that represents a return address. It says, when you're all done executing, transfer control to this address, which is the instruction immediately following the call. So that means if I had something like call M of 3, the return address would point to that location immediately after the call of M of 3. So I'll call M, it'll get a frame, it'll get parameters, it'll execute, and finally says time to return. In place it returns is this little pointer that says I want you to continue right after the call site for the guy that activated you. So what we'll have then is some control information, things like a return address. We'll then have space for a parameter and all the local variables and possibly some padding, because oftentimes the stack wants to be allocated on a single or double word boundary just to make memory allocation faster. So what we're going to do then as we process, go back, is that as we process the declaration of a method, we're going to say one of our jobs, as I showed you earlier today, is to allocate data that for the code that the user writes. But if the data are inside of a method, a subprogram, whatever, it's not going to be a static allocation. It's going to be the allocation of a block of data called a frame that has slots for each and every allocation the user wants. And I'll just draw those as horizontal. So in this case, we had space for the control info, and then a B and C. And of course, the amount of space allocated will be dependent on the amount of data and the size of the data. So what we'll do is we'll keep track of a little bit of offsetting. Let's get ahead there again. So it says, we'll always assume that a frame begins at offset 0. So what will happen is when I actually allocate that frame, I'll take a pointer that's called the frame pointer that says here's where the frame is actually allocated, add in the offset, and that'll give me access to the exact location where the data are currently allocated. One call may have the data in one spot, another call may have it in a different spot. It doesn't matter. The data will be allocated when the call is made, and depending on how many other calls are pending, it may be at a different location in the stack. Doesn't matter to the user. But it's really important to us to give us this flexibility that the stack can grow and shrink. If I do lots of pending calls, the stack is deep. If I return from them, the stack becomes more shallow. So in this particular case, we will do bookkeeping. Turns out in the JVM, the bookkeeping is easier, but in general, it's not too hard. You have a little rule that says, here's the size of each piece of data, and if I have multiple copies, like an array, it's the size times the number of elements. So in this case, it said, the offset always starts 0. Let's assume that we need 2 words, 8 bytes of control info. One of them will be the return address, and others we'll see shortly is something called a dynamic link. The dynamic link says, when I return from one frame, how do I find the previous frame? The link shows you that. So it says, okay, I have an integer A. On most machines, integers are 32 bits, 4 bytes. So it says the offset changes, in this case, by 4. Goes to 12. In this case, B, B was a double, so it needs 8. And then C is an array, and is an array of 10, I believe, doubles, so that means it needs 80 bytes. And you add that all together, add any padding that's needed, it says This frame is 104 bytes in size. I'll store that in the assembly table when I'm code-generating, and whenever I generate a call, it says, how do I allocate data for a subprogram? That is, I'll allocate a frame. And let's see if we have an example of... No, I'm getting too far ahead. I'll draw you one. So what happens is we have a stack, and let's assume we have the stack growing upward just for visible. We have something called this top of stack, and that's actually a location. In many cases in a machine, it's a register. If you look at machine designs, oftentimes they have something called a stack top register. Now, in our particular case, there will be a stack top hidden in the JVM so that the JVM always knows where the top of its stack is. And I can say things like push and pop, and it'll adjust that to implement the stack. So these would be previous frames. And I decide to do a call. So what happens is I push space. How do I push space on a stack? Well, depending on if the stack grows to higher addresses or lower addresses, I simply adjust the stack top. So if this guy needed 104 bytes, whatever this top value was, I'd reset this to point to the top value plus 104. So effectively, I've allocated space. And if this guy wants to call somebody else, I push that space on the stack, and on and on and on. So the important point to notice, if we go back to this, is when I'm compiling, I don't assign fixed addresses, I assign offsets. And those offsets, which were illustrated here, are stored in a symbol table. And he says, well, wait a minute, that's a pretty clumsy way of doing things. But it turns out on real computers, it's not. What happens is, in a real computer, you say, I want to load some data. Let's see, A is at offset 8. So I want to address some data for A. I have a pointer here called the frame pointer. And I say I want to have FP plus 8. And one of the interesting things about computer design is it looks like I have to spend some time doing arithmetic. But it turns out real computers, if you've had some computer architecture course, it turns out there are ways in computers to address data in a relative manner of the form a register plus a fixed offset. So you can say register comma offset, something like register 8. And the actual implementation of the hardware will do that addition for you for free. So there's not any extra cost. Allocating something at register plus 8 or allocating it from a fixed address like 1, 2, 3, 4 takes exactly the same amount of time. That's a little counterintuitive, but computer designers have been very clever to make things we want execute very quickly and maybe things we don't want execute more slowly. But it turns out that to support stack allocation, we can access data in the form a pointer plus an offset and have it run equally fast to if it was had an absolute fixed address. That means the flexibility I have up here of growing and shrinking a stack is essentially free. Moreover, I get the advantage of being able to do recursion, where I can have multiple instances of the same subprogram that have different data allocations by simply allocating different frames at different positions in the stack. So the takeaway from this is we're going to allocate some data on the stack, and particularly anything that's local data in a method. And if you think about most languages like Java, virtually everything is done inside of a method. You call main to start things off, and it calls something, and it calls something, and it calls something. So any data that is local to a method will be pushed on the stack. The things that typically are not are things that are called static. And statics oftentimes are globals. Remember, a class can have various static fields, which are the same across all calls. Those things are allocated with a fixed address so that they're always accessible consistently through any routine that needs it. So I was saying, we have this notion then of allocating data in frames, and these are going to be on a stack. So the way we'll do this, and let's see if we have a little diagram of it. Yeah, I'll get ahead of that, is we'll have a stack that contains two pieces of information. Let's see if I have any more. fresh paper here. So we'll have a stack, and stacks will always have a top pointer. That's always the top of the stack. And we'll always have that the current frame, that is the frame that belongs to the method that's executing right now, will be on the top of the stack. So that's the current frame. And the beginning of the frame will be referenced by a frame pointer. And again, many real machines have two separate registers allocated, one for the top of the stack and one for the frame. Now, it looks like I'm being a little bit wasteful. Why should I have two pointers when one might do? And the answer is that many times a method will have data whose size is unpredictable at compile time. Our language does not have it, but many languages allow variable size arrays. That is, I can say, please give me an int a of size I, where I might be a parameter, for example. And it says, please go ahead and give me an array that has as many locations as the parameter demands. When that happens, the extra space, it's indeterminate until runtime, how much space I need, is pushed beyond the frame on top of the stack. And what happens is the current frame then has a pointer to where that data is found. So because the frame size is not always absolutely fixed, we're going to actually implement things so that we have a stack top, and that always points to the top of the stack. Now, implementation-wise, you can either have the frame point, the stack pointer point to the last used location or the first unused location. That's a matter of consistency. You can choose either one. And the frame pointer will point to the very beginning of the current frame. So we access through the top and the frame pointer. And one of the things that will allow us to do is support recursion. And here's an example of a very commonly used routine that's recursive, and it's simply down because it's very simple to write and understand. So it says the factorial is the product of all numbers starting at 1 up to a limit. So it's 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5 times whatever until you reach the parameter. One way, certainly not the only way, but one way to implement that is recursively, which says I can define the factorial of n to be n times the factorial of n minus 1. I can implement that just to show that recursion has a use. Well, here's the definition of it as code, but now I have a problem. I have multiple occurrences of fact, and where do I put its data? And the answer, of course, is I put it in a frame. And let me illustrate this here. So here's a case where I'm calling factorial of 3. And to compute factorial of 3, it's going to have to call factorial of 2, get a sub-answer. Factorial of 2 will call factorial of 1. I have a base case that says when n is less than or equal to 1, the answer is automatically 1. So that terminates the recursion. And here's the memory setup I have. This is the stack I happen to have. It says I'm going to have an extra location, since this is a function, for the return value. That'll always end up being the very first value in the frame, and therefore it'll look like it's on the top of the stack when I return. So I have here control information, and I have a single local variable, the parameter n, which is 3. It says, hey, I have to call 2, so it goes ahead and calls 2 and has a different return address, and potentially, and a different parameter, and it ends up calling 1. So at the point where I'm about to terminate the recursion, I have factorial of 1, and it says, okay, that's 1, so I return there. When I return, let me finish my thought and we'll be done. It says, okay, the return value is 1. It returns to the intermediate call and says, hey, my value is 2. 2 times the return value is 2. I'll put that in my return value right here, and it returns. It then says, okay, the original call was for factorial of 3. That's 3 times whatever the return value was. That was 2. So 3 times 2 is 6, and it returns the value. So recursion is handled very normally by simply creating extra instances of the frame, each for some sub-value. It executes and returns, and the entire recursion works properly. It's a good place to stop. We'll pick that up next time. I see many of you tomorrow, I think, and good luck to you then. I'll try to get here a bit early, so if there's any last-minute questions, I'll be able to handle those. And those few of you who have already had your exams, you can smile and say, whoa, I'm all done with it. I don't have to worry.